All right, everyone. We are back for another episode of the Hallenstein Center's podcast series, Off the Stage. I am Maddie Miller, and I'm the media specialist for the Hallenstein Center. Tomorrow is November 11th, which is Veterans Day, a day here in the United States where we honor all who have served in our armed forces. If you are listening to this and are a veteran, on behalf of the Hallenstein Center, thank you so much for your service to our country. And I have the pleasure of being seated across from a veteran right now, Jason Redmond. Thank you for serving our country. Happy Veterans Day a day early, and thanks for being on the podcast.
Yeah, honored to be here. To all my fellow veterans out there, man, so much respect. Mm-hmm. I got to work with every branch of the armed service throughout my career, and there is no doubt in my mind we have one of the best militaries in the world.
Yeah, that's awesome. For those listening, Jason is in Grand Rapids for our Celebration of Veterans Day event, which is happening tonight. So if you're listening to this podcast, the event has already happened. But do not worry, we always have a recording of all of our events available on YouTube and in podcast form. So please make sure you check out the link in the description below to hear Jason's keynote. Again, thank you for traveling to Grand Rapids. We have a lot of people excited for your presentation tonight. You seem like a great speaker, but do you ever get nervous to speak in front of a crowd?
Not very often anymore. Okay. I mean, every now and then, maybe not anymore. I'm very confident in my speaking abilities.
Yeah.
But I will say every now and then when I speak in front of my peers, I mean, I've been asked to come back talk sometimes in front of the SEAL teams. And I think for anyone, speaking in front of your peers kind of changes the dynamic a little bit.
Yeah,
so that'd probably be the only time.
Yeah. That's great. Well, you have great speaking abilities. To prepare for this podcast, I did a little bit of a deep dive on your website and stuff, and you seem like a great speaker. So we're excited for tonight. We are going to start out the podcast. We start out every podcast, which is with the bowl of questions, which you have sitting in front of you. For those listening, these were questions that were submitted via social media. So make sure you follow us on social media so that you can submit future questions for future speakers. But just want to grab one out of there, read it, and then you can answer it.
All right. I love this. First question. What is your favorite college football team? No, that's not what it says.
No, you can answer that question. I need all
there
of my Michigan.
A lot of people that are going to be delete.
No, please answer that question. I need everybody to know.
I am from the great state of Ohio, and I am a huge fan of the Ohio State University. Go Bucks.
I could not feel more connected right now, especially in the state of Michigan.
I know, there are people cringing right now. They're like, we really liked him.
And the best part is actually our speaker from our event last month was a professor at Ohio State. So we had the same exchange, and I'm like, I need all the Michigan people to know there are Buckeyes here and we're proud.
Yep.
So I love it. Thank
you. Well, shout out to my son-in-law, Ian. He is a diehard Wolverine fan. So we do have some blue in the family.
Yeah. My brother-in-law, my sister got married a few years ago. My brother-in-law is a Michigan State fan. So that is a continually.
I'm good with Michigan State.
Yeah. Michigan State's
It's the Ann Arbor. The north. So this is an interesting I love this. So the question is, if you could have one exotic animal as a pet, what would you choose?
Good one.
I would have a tiger.
Yeah. Okay, straight up.
Easy day. Tiger.
Yeah. Just in your backyard, or would you want it to be an indoor pet?
I think I'd have it roam the house. We have a lot of pets. I've always joked with this.
You do have pets.
So it would clear the house, and then I'd only have a tiger. So it also, I mean, a great deterrent against people breaking into the house. I mean, my German Shepherd's really good, but I mean, could you imagine being a criminal and you look in and they're like, oh my God, they have a tiger. Yeah. I mean, think about it. The dog barks. People are scared of that, but I mean, think about tiger growl.
Yeah. And think about all your neighbors too. Like, I feel like your neighbors would be like, oh, there's that house that has the tiger. I don't know, could be a good
I teach self-defense. I mean, I think a tiger is a great way.
Love that.
Yeah,
I love that answer. Let's do one more.
All right,
one more BOQ.
All right. Actually, there is a separate little, so I'm going to go with that because all these pages are white and this one's yellow.
Yeah,
I think it's special.
It's a different round.
It's special. All right, here's the question. If you could only eat one meal for the rest of your life, what would it be? Good question. It would be sushi.
Sushi.
I love sushi and it's healthy.
Yeah.
You know, so I would be okay
eating
sushi.
What's your favorite roll? like a roll of sushi.
Probably a tuna roll.
Tuna?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, tuna roll with avocado.
I would say of sushi, that's probably my least favorite. I usually like a salmon or a shrimp.
I love a salmon roll too. Like that, salmon, yellowtail, tuna, those are my go-tos.
Yeah, that's good. Love it.
With a little sake.
Yes, that's great.
All right.
All right. We are going to move on to the questions that I have prepared for the podcast.
Those were fun. Thanks for submitting.
Yeah, I love it. So I always like to kind of just start with every one of my guests, like at the beginning. So like, tell us where you grew up, which you've already talked about a little bit, your background, your childhood, what was your family like? What did you do for fun growing up? Those kinds of things.
Yeah. So originally from the great state of Ohio, although we left there relatively young, my parents divorced and I ended up kind of bouncing back and forth between my parents and both of them started moving. My dad moved to North Carolina. My mom stayed in Ohio until I was about 7, and then she moved to the Virgin Islands.
Okay.
So I started going down to the Virgin Islands, and I would just go back and forth between my parents. So I lived North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, down to the Virgin Islands for a while. And so that's kind of how I grew up.
Yeah.
I love the water, you know, obviously living down in the Virgin Islands, so snorkeling and awesome. Bodyboarding and just any water activities. And then I lived a decent amount of time in North Carolina where my dad ended up settling. Okay. So I spent a lot of time in the woods. Mm-hmm. I'm not a huge hunter, but I have an appreciation for hunting and I love the outdoors and anything like that. So, you know, today, things I like to do, I love to golf.
Okay.
I'm not very good, but I love doing it.
Yeah, the outdoors.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That's definitely awesome.
And I like riding motorcycles and, you know, those are the things I enjoy.
Those outdoorsy things. I love that. So you spent 11 years as a Navy SEAL. Tell us about that initial decision to enlist. Did you always know you were going to do that, or what kind of... made you decide to enlist?
Yeah, absolutely. And 21 years.
Oh, 21
So, yeah,
years,
I did 21
I actually,
years total. I know
I
sometimes it
wrote
breaks.
It wrong.
No, well, it's
notes.
The way it's written. We wrote it that way. It says, I think it says 11 years as an enlisted SEAL and then 10 years as a SEAL officer.
Oh,
so,
that's
21
a
years total.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I grew up in a very patriotic family that had all served.
Okay.
So I grew up listening to stories about my grandparents, both on, interestingly, my mom is a first generation American out of Canada, although my grandparents had come from France.
Okay.
So my grandfather had fought with the French in World War II. And after the war, they moved to Canada. And then when my mom was, I think, 24, they moved down into America. Mm-hmm. My mom didn't speak a lick of English, so only French, and had to learn English and great. They loved America. They loved America, which was kind of cool to grow up under that.
Yeah.
My dad, his side of the family, they lived in Ohio. They had a business in Ohio and he and my mom had met. But my dad was Army, but it was the stories of both my grandparents that really inspired me. The stories coming out of World War II. My dad's dad was a highly decorated B-24 pilot, all his missions in the European theater, awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, 7 Air Medals.
Awesome.
Yeah, really cool. And then, so growing up, and then I have stories of my dad was a paratrooper and a rigger. He packed parachutes and, you know, had helped people jump out of airplanes. So I thought that was really cool as a kid.
That is cool.
And, when I was about, so I'd always wanted to go in the military from a young age. I wanted to be a pilot. Yeah. I grew up and this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a pilot like my grandfather, like Top Gun. I was like, I'm going to be Maverick, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I was like, yes.
Yes.
And, but as I got a little older, you know, I grew up in the G.I. Joe generation.
Okay.
So I was really, like many young men, kind of fascinated with special operations, Storm Shadow, Snake Eyes, these kind of guys.
Yeah.
And my dad said, well, if you're interested in that, there was a group of guys that went through airborne school with us. He said they were called Navy SEALs. He said, you know, you you know, from my time in the Virgin Islands, he said, you're good in the water. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you should look into this. And I did. And this was the late 80s. There was not a whole lot. The internet didn't exist. I know that's hard to believe, but yeah. The internet did not exist. And there wasn't a whole lot of information about the seals back then. Okay. But what I could find really piqued my interest. It was like mm-hmm. hardest training in the entire U.S. military, very secretive. Some of our premier special operations and mm-hmm. obviously on the maritime side. So for whatever reason, and I'm the most unlikely candidate to go down this path because I was a runt.
I was just gonna say why would you say you're unlikely?
Well, because I back then I didn't play sports. Okay. I would not have been anyone who you would have looked at and said that guy's gonna become a Navy SEAL.
Okay.
I was really small. I blossomed late, and even now I'm not that big a guy. Mm-hmm. You know, and people have in their minds that SEALs are these great big muscle-bound yeah. Schwarzenegger types. And, you know, back then when I started mm-hmm. to think this was my path, I was literally the, you know, 95-pound weakling at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
But I locked onto that and I said, that's mm-hmm. what I want to do. And interesting. That is the path I went, and I'm definitely on the smaller end of the spectrum for most SEALs. But what most people don't realize is most SEALs are not that big.
Yep.
The average SEAL is 5'10", 180.
Wow.
And yeah.
Not what I would have imagined.
Yeah. No, we hear that a lot.
Yeah. So, that's cool.
Yeah.
What was the, like, how did your friends and family respond when you decided to make this decision? Obviously it's something you talked to your parents a lot about. So they probably weren't super surprised.
Yes and no. Okay. They were not surprised, obviously, because mm-hmm. that I'd always been talking about that.
Yeah.
Some of it, they definitely supported it. Some of it, I became a knucklehead as I got a little older in my teenage years and got kicked out of the house. Mm-hmm. But I will say that was the only thing that kept me. I was smart enough to recognize if I got myself in real trouble, it would stop that journey. I knew I needed yeah. a clearance, so it kept me away from drugs or doing anything really stupid that some of my friends were doing. So so I kind of got rebellious, but at least smart enough not to jeopardize my career. So mm-hmm. I kind of made that decision, like, this is what I'm going to do. And thankfully, both my parents supported it. Even, you know, my dad went and signed for me, even though I'd been kicked out at that point. And my mom, very supportive, which now as I'm a parent, I can see where that would be difficult to think, wow, my kid's going to go do a dangerous job.
Yeah.
That's hard to wrap your head around. For sure. My parents were very supportive, which was really nice.
That's nice. That's awesome. So I'm excited to hear a little bit more about your story tonight at our event. For those who are listening and not familiar, in 2007, Jason was wounded while deployed in Iraq, and you have this amazing story about this sign you hung on the door of your hospital room, and I'm super excited to hear more about that, but I'm going to save that for the event tonight and for our listeners who, if you weren't able to attend, we have a recording of it, so please go listen to that. But what I would really love to hear more about is maybe the more logistical side of your recovery process. So tell us, like, a little bit just about, like, the timeline of your recovery. How long did it take? What kind of treatments did you have to go through? What was the hardest part? Like, those kinds of things.
Yeah, I love those questions because they're not things that I typically get to talk about.
Exactly.
And I'm fascinated with the human body, how mm-hmm. both fragile and resilient it is. If I'd walked a different path in this life, I'd probably be a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I love the human body and to be able to, it's amazing.
Yes.
So, here are some of the interesting things. Okay. I was wounded on September 13th, and the medevac process is so amazing. And we got a big shout out to Secretary Robert Gates, who really learned. They analyzed and saw a lot of lessons under his guidance as Secretary of Defense mm-hmm. out of Vietnam, and the way they configured the medevac system in Iraq and in Afghanistan saved a lot of lives. We have one of the highest survival rates in warfare in our history.
That's awesome.
And there's no doubt that I'm alive today because of that.
That's awesome.
From the time I was wounded, 96 hours later, I was back in America at Bethesda Naval Hospital.
Wow.
And I had moved, and I had had multiple surgeries between. I went from, so they initially took me to Baghdad to save my life. So big shout out to all our military medical professionals. Mm-hmm. I owe my life to them who saved me. They moved me from Baghdad after they saved me to Balad, where head injuries were sent in Iraq. Okay. So I went to Balad. And then they moved me to Longstuhl, where I had a couple more surgeries to stabilize me. And then they put me on the ICU medevac flight to fly across back to Bethesda. So pretty amazing, 96
that
hours.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that process is insane. So then recovery, like in total, I guess, like how long of a process was that?
So 4 years, 40 surgeries.
Okay.
Yeah, so very, a lot of people, what we don't realize, and even I didn't realize, I mean, I worked in a, you know, special operations, a pretty dangerous career. I had seen friends who had been shot or killed, mm-hmm. But oftentimes when you think of an injury, kind of a funny story. I remember only a couple of weeks prior to being wounded, we did over 80 missions when I was in Iraq.
Okay.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
But on the few nights we weren't working, mm-hmm. usually we, you know, there was a group of us that we would sit around and play poker, mm-hmm. And talk and talk a lot of smack. And somehow one night we got on the subject of what happens, what would happen if you got shot? Like if you got shot, where would you want to be shot? And yeah, it was an interesting conversation.
Yeah.
So for all of us, we were all like, definitely in the lower leg, you know, because prosthetics had come a long way, mm-hmm. and be like, yeah, I can still serve if I've got a lower leg prosthetic. I was like, yeah, I don't want to be shot in the arms. You know, I'm a smaller guy. So I was like, definitely the leg. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee none of us said, yeah, I'd like to be shot in the face. So kind of a funny dialogue, but interesting because later being shot and, you know, I took two rounds in the left elbow, which did a lot of damage. Mm-hmm. They originally were going to amputate my arm.
Wow.
And the only reason I still have an arm is mere fate. For those who are believers, you could say it's a God moment. Mm-hmm. But the only reason I have an arm, the entire orthopedic department at Bethesda said the best thing to do is amputate this guy's arm above the elbow.
Mm-hmm.
The head orthopedic surgeon at Bethesda was a former SEAL.
Wow.
And he said, I'm going to figure out how to save your arm. And he went against the rest of the team, and I still have an arm, and my and it works fairly well.
I was just going to say, is there any like physical limitations?
Yeah,
you
yeah,
have?
Absolutely. Okay. So I can't bend my arm any further than this.
Okay.
I can't extend any further than
that.
I still have some nerve damage. My grip strength is a lot weaker in my left hand by far, but I have an arm, and I can do a lot. So I'm so thankful for him.
Mm-hmm.
And his conviction and taking care of a SEAL brother. And it was a huge, you know, to suffer severe injuries is really a hard journey.
100%.
Battlefield injuries are really dirty, so there's a lot of infection problems. And I had a lot of infection problems. There's the journey is often two steps forward, one step back. Sometimes it's one step forward and three steps back.
Yeah.
And to have him and be like, wow, I got a fellow teammate, a SEAL in my corner, you know, fighting for me, was really a nice confidence booster I went through that initial journey.
Yeah, and that's a long journey, too. 4 years is insane.
His name was Dan Vilek. So, Dan, I know you're out there. You're working in Bethesda now, retired, but much love, brother. I appreciate you.
That's awesome. So then what did that returning back to, what did you have to get cleared? Do you have to pass certain tests to go back into your career, or what did that look like?
Yeah, and unfortunately, I never passed those tests.
Yeah.
I mean, it was my goal in the beginning to get back operational, and I worked very hard. I, you know, rehab all the time, and thankfully, in a regular military unit, probably they would have processed me out. My injuries. Even with the work they did, I had major limitations. My facial injuries were pretty severe.
Mm-hmm.
But thankfully, Special Operations also has the ability to kind of protect and insulate their people. And the leadership of the SEAL team said, hey, if you want to stay, we're going to keep you.
Yeah.
So I said, hey, I want to stay. I come into the military to do a career. So I said, look, I want to get back operational. If I can't be operational, I still want to serve and I want to finish my career. I want to do 20 years.
Okay.
So they said, no problem. So for the first couple of years, I worked really hard to get back operational, but it would never happen. I got out of the military medical system due to the complexity of my injuries.
Okay.
And the military has amazing doctors and nurses and but most doctors in the military do not specialize at the level that civilian doctors do. And what happens is a lot of civilian specialists, they get into very niche parts. Like, there's only a few doctors in the world who can do total nasal reconstruction, which is something I needed.
Yeah.
There's only a handful of doctors in the world who do facial reconstruction. And like, I lost a lot of, the structural integrity of my skull was compromised because of the amount of bone I lost in my skull.
Yeah.
And there's only, there's not a whole lot of doctors out there who specialize in that. So there are a lot in the military that may dabble in it.
Yeah, but not specialized.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it was nice that I was able to get out. And I literally, the guy who rebuilt my face is probably the best facial reconstruction and plastic surgeon in the world.
Okay.
His name is Dr. Eduardo Rodriguez, Ed Rodriguez. And he's in New York now. But when I met him, he was at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore Shock Trauma. Mm-hmm. And just amazing guy who took care of me. Many of you may remember a groundbreaking surgery, the very first facial transplant they did years ago by a woman who got her face bit off by a baboon.
Wow.
Yeah. Nice. Probably 2011, 12 maybe is when this occurred. And they did a facial transplant, the first one ever done, and Dr. Rodriguez led that surgery.
Wow.
So very fortunate, you know, this path and how it's intersected and happened. Yeah. I had an amazing doctor out of Johns Hopkins who rebuilt my arm, my elbow, which gave me some movement, which I didn't have in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Phase one was let's amputate. Phase two was my elbow was literally fused in place. So I couldn't bend it at all.
Yeah, it was just, there.
And they said, that's the best you're ever going to have. Mm-hmm. And then this doctor, Andy Egelsetter, out of Hopkins, redid it. And I think they wrote medical journals about what he did to rebuild it. And I tried to find other doctors who could do more. Yeah. And they were just like, man, you have literally the best
the
you can get.
Yeah.
So finally at that point, I accepted, all right, you're never going to be operational again.
Yeah.
But I was able to get back. I worked and operations. I worked some special projects. I worked some programs that were really neat to take care of our wounded and families of fallen SEALs before I retired in 2013.
That's awesome. That's so cool to hear that you were able to help in a different area.
Yeah.
And still finish out that career.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very important to me, and I appreciate the leadership of the SEAL teams taking care of me and letting me finish my career for the most part on my terms.
Yeah. That's awesome. My next question for you is, so this year, the Howard Science Center, we actually have like a theme for our programming, and it is empowered citizenship, which is just thinking about, you know, what it means for us to be a citizen of our country and be a citizen also of the world, and how that impacts how we show up and live our day-to-day lives. So as someone who has served our country and now serves in different ways by providing leadership and coaching, and you know, what does it look like for you to feel like you are an empowered citizen in America?
I love this question. It's a really important question. As a veteran and an individual that served in this military, you know, why did you do it? I think everybody has their different reasons on why they serve. But at the end of the day, for me, there was some of it came from my family. So there was this, I wanted to serve. I wanted to be a part of, you know, this protector community, if you will. But as I did it more, that grew. And it became, for us, out of 9/11, it became this very evil threat. of an extremist ideology that was really, it came to our homeland and they targeted our people and our belief system. And I was like, I don't want my kids to have to grow up and face this. So I had that option. And then that final option was, you know, this idea of freedom and opportunity is a really powerful thing. What our founding fathers created, and our nation is not perfect. And I'm frustrated that there are people out there that want to rip apart the foundations of our country. And they're not perfect. It was, you know, those weren't perfect times, but man, we have grown, and the advances we've made in this nation are amazing. So when I talk about, when you talk about empowered citizenship, I think what it really comes down to is how do we continue to preserve what this experiment of freedom. No country in the world has ever been created like America. And there are some people that, you know, Americans, we can be a little bold, we can be a little boastful, but it was built on this resilience and sacrifice and grit, and that needs to continue forward. And we need to make sure that the average American understands that no country in the world, in the history of the world, has gone around the world and done more. I mean, this is a fact. This isn't, this is just a statement of fact that America has done. You know, we have sacrificed more American lives on battlefields abroad fighting for other countries' freedoms or things like this than any nation on this planet. And that is a powerful thing to understand, because freedom and opportunity, there's a cost that comes with it. And so as a citizen of this nation, I think understanding and appreciating that cost, recognizing that freedom, a lot of people see freedom kind of like as air.
Yeah.
It's just there. Mm-hmm. And in this nation for so long, we've just had it. Mm-hmm. And you just breathe it in day in and day out, and you don't think anything of it.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about freedom, no different than air, if I suddenly choked you out, you would suddenly realize the importance of air.
Yes.
No different if we took away your freedom, how much you would realize how much you needed it,
mm-hmm.
or wished you had it. And I think for empowered citizens, it's this idea that you have to be intentional about how you live your life in this country. I love JFK's quote of, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And there's a large sense right now of, hey, we want the government to take care of us in all these different aspects. And personally, I'm not a fan of that. I think there are times when people are struggling where the government can help. But I think there should be a limitation, and we should definitely empower our citizens to be their own people. I am a huge fan of freedom and being your own person.
Mm-hmm.
And I put things in place for you have the ability to do that, and you should be able to use programs that are out there, but you should be your own person. And that is how you get back. That is how it mm-hmm. feeds our country. It feeds freedom and opportunity. It feeds our financial system and all these things, and raising your kids to know and understand that, I think, is a critical thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a great perspective. One that I haven't talked about on the podcast, so I love that. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, Maddie.
I have a couple more questions for you. Next one is, again, I did a little deep dive on your website. So I saw that you use in your coaching this thing you called the Pentagon of Peak Performance, which has five components, which are spiritual, emotional, physical, mental, and social. I was wondering if it would be okay if you shared what that spiritual component looks like for you.
Yeah, so spiritual leadership is the highest level of the Pentagon. And I think it's really critical. I think you need all, when I talk about the Pentagon and peak performance, or I write about this in my mm-hmm. book, Overcome, and I have a program online called the Point Man for Life program about being a point man for your own life. And balance in the Pentagon is a really important thing.
Mm-hmm.
Good leaders will put time and effort into all five of those areas, mm-hmm. and it enables to be balanced when life throws, you know, the bombs and bullets of life hit us.
Sure.
Spiritual leadership is the highest, and where that comes into play, for some people, it is faith. Mm-hmm. For me, faith plays a part in my spiritual leadership, but mm-hmm. not everybody buys into that. And I understand faith is a very difficult thing. It is an intangible thing that we cannot see, touch, quantify. So for a lot of people, when I talk about spiritual leadership, it is a mixture of perspective and getting outside of yourself. And understanding, you know, as humans, there's a natural tendency. We all focus inward. You know, how do I benefit myself? How do I feel good? How do I influence myself that directly influences the sphere of influence around me? And when things are going wrong, it's natural to focus totally inward and woe is me and lose our perspective. And I think spiritual leadership enables us to turn outward and recognize that there's a great big world out there. And especially those of us who are fortunate enough to live in a first world country, your problems are not that big. I know you think you are, and right now, some of you listening to this are going through what I call a life ambush. That's a whole nother thing I talk about. You're being hit by the bullets and bombs of life, and they're painful and they're hard. And it's easy to be like, oh, woe is me. You don't know what you're talking about, Jason Redman. I'm going through hell, and no one understands, and it's just not true. Spiritual leadership enables you to look outward and say, wow, I'm so thankful I'm not in Israel and Gaza right now. I'm so thankful I'm not in Ukraine right now. I'm so thankful I'm not in, you know, Africa where genocide is happening, you know, modern day slavery is still occurring, you know, all these different things that are occurring. Spiritual leadership enables you to take a step back and go, you know what? I'm grateful for the life I have. Yes, I have problems. Yes, this is hard, but that is where it comes into play. Well, how do we do that? And you do that by being intentional. Maybe meditating, maybe it's breathing exercises, but you have to do things that make you turn away from your everyday problems and your everyday activities. Faith is one thing that helps with this, but if you're not into faith, then look at other things that can help you. Go volunteer. Go open your eyes to there are other people out there that are suffering far beyond what you're probably going through.
I love that perspective, that idea of like looking, you know, at the world as so much bigger than ourselves. There's a much bigger picture playing here. And I think that's really, I feel like that's something that you can always tell in really great leaders is that they don't always think inward. It's a great quality in a leader when they can think more broadly and think of others and stuff like that. So.
So many Americans, you know, going back to citizenship, so many Americans have never left our borders. Many Americans have never even left their own state. And nothing wrong with that. But it's critical to educate yourself and understand the big world beyond our borders. Yes. I've been all over the world. I have seen the highest levels of poverty, highest levels of violence and depraved behavior. And yes, we have some issues, but it's a pretty darn good place. And understanding that and having that perspective, I love that Israel has a program where everybody serves in the military, and it gives them this unity and bond. Whenever I meet any Israeli citizens, it is the first thing that they connect with. Like, oh, well, who did you serve with? No different than veterans here. It gives us this bond. And it also, military service forces individuals to have to work with people from all different walks of life. You have to learn how to work with people that may not have the same ideology as you or the same demographics and background. And you have to learn how to lead and deal. So I wish in our nation we had a program. Stan McChrystal, General Stan McChrystal, ran operations in Afghanistan. He was one of my bosses. And he had an idea that we should have a service program in America. It doesn't have to be military because not everybody wants to be in the military. But if we had five or six different service areas where young Americans would have to go spend some time learning, going to different places, maybe in this country or even abroad, and giving back, it would give so much more perspective, which would give so much more appreciation and understanding the gift of freedom and opportunity we have here.
That's awesome. That's a great perspective. I love it. I have two more questions for you, and they're both pretty quick. First, I would just love to hear a little bit more about your family, where you currently live, what you guys do for fun, just kind of something like that.
So I live in southeastern Virginia, and I have an amazing family. My wife is incredible. Any of you that may have read my book, The Trident, or if you want to read my book, The Trident, I follow our entire journey from the time we met all the way to the end. And I wanted to highlight how amazing our military spouses are, and specifically special operations spouses. Yeah. So really fortunate. My wife and I, we have been through the thick of it. We've been together for 24 years, 22 years married, three amazing successful kids, 24, 21, and 19 now, who are out there and, you know, figuring out how to make their own marks on the world. Yeah. And I love my family. Everything is about family. I work a lot, but when I can, you know, we want to be together doing things. Our favorite activity is skiing.
Oh, awesome.
Or snowboarding.
Yeah.
And we make time at least once a year for all of us to get together, and we all go, we'll be doing that in the new year. We're excited. I'm taking 11 days off and just to be with them. So, yeah.
That's cool. Love to hear it.
Yeah.
The last question is the way I end all of these off the stage podcasts. And that is, I always just like to ask people, what advice would you have for someone wanting to do what you do? So for, you know, for you wanting to enlist in the military, serve our country, what advice would you give them? Or for someone who's currently serving?
I am such a fan of service to our nation. So it just teaches you so many things. So if there's any of you out there who want to serve, please do it. Mm-hmm. And don't ever think, I meet people who are like, well, you know, I wanted to go into special operations, but I can't, or maybe you can't do the primary job. Mm-hmm. There is no job in the military. The military is one of the more efficient organizations in the United States of America. And the job wouldn't exist if it didn't provide some level of support that enables the mission. Yeah. So no matter what you do in the military, you are contributing. You are part of the team that's enabling the military to do what it does. Mm-hmm. So, and you will learn so much going through boot camp, learning how to deal with adversity, learning leadership, teamwork, learning how to be goal and purpose driven or mission driven in the military. These are things that you're going to learn. So if you're thinking about doing it, do it. Even if you only go in, I've heard some veterans complain like, oh, I see kids that are coming in and all they want to do is come in to get an education. Good.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. You know, understand though, you know, what is the function of the military?
Sure.
We defend our nation and sometimes have to wage wars against our enemies. Mm-hmm. So never lose sight of that. You know, when you come in, yes, we will provide you an education. Yes, there are so many great benefits to our veterans. But at the end of the day, there is an aspect of our job that mm-hmm. you have to accept. This is part of the job. But you will learn so much. So I encourage you to do it. For those who are maybe thinking about it, I don't know what to do with my life. Go into the military for 4 years.
Yeah.
It'll pay for your college. It'll provide you with medical benefits through the VA. It'll give you discounts on buying homes. There's so many benefits to it. And you will grow and learn to be a better human all across the board.
For sure. That's great. That was a great way to end the podcast. Thank you so much. Thanks for being here with us to celebrate Veterans Day. We're excited to hear you speak tonight. And for those listening, again, I will link below the links to the podcast or to the YouTube to watch Jason's keynote. And also I will link to his website so that if you're interested in anything he talked about, his different books and whatnot, you can check it out there. But thank you for listening.
Yeah. Happy Veterans Day, guys.
Thank you for listening to Off the Stage Podcast, a series produced by the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. The Hauenstein Center, inspired by Ralph Hauenstein's life of leadership and service, is dedicated to raising a community of ethical, effective leaders for the 21st century. For more information on our center, our Cook Leadership Academy, or our Common Ground Initiative, visit our website at www.gvsu.edu/hc. To keep up with our current events and reoccurring initiatives, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, all of which can be found linked below. If you liked this episode, consider giving us a review or rating so we can be found by other podcast listeners. Again, thanks for listening to Off the Stage Podcast.